Good morning and welcome to the Colorado Court of Appeals Division 3. We have one case scheduled on our 9 o'clock docket this morning, and that is the case of D.R. Horton versus Bischoff and Kaufman et al. Are counsel present and ready to proceed in that case?
Yes, Judge.
Good morning. Good morning. You should have received a set of written instructions detailing our oral argument procedures. And I know counsel are not strangers to this court, but do you have any questions about the instructions?
No.
If not, we'll proceed to the argument. And I want to remind you to please identify yourself by name and registration number when you come to the podium. And I'd ask everybody in the courtroom to please shut off your pager or cell phone so that there are no interruptions during argument. With that, please begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Marcy Glenn. I represent D.R. Horton. My registration number is 12018. I'd like to begin by discussing the district court's exclusion of all evidence related to D.R. Horton's settlement with the Homeowners Association other than the fact of settlement. The jury in this case heard nothing about the amount of the settlement of the underlying claim, what portion of that amount was allocated to the three subcontractors who are involved in this appeal.
How much was allocated to these three?
It was about $3.78 million of a total settlement of $25 million.
Okay. If I might just move ahead to damages.
Absolutely.
Let's assume that we agree with you on certain points. But your opponent has suggested that any error in this case is harmless because you got damages for breach of contract. Let's leave away the settlement conference for the moment and just move forward. They argue that you got damages for breach of contract, albeit not much. Mm-hmm. And any of the judge's errors with respect to breach of warranty would have made no difference because the damages were exactly the same. Would you care to comment on that?
Sure. The damages awarded were actually for the breach of warranty claim.
Okay, so
and
it's
the argument
versa. Go
is
ahead.
Just reverse that the damages, that the errors on the breach of contract claim and on the indemnity claim, they say, are moot because we got those damages and there wouldn't have been any different damages.
Right. How would they have been different?
Well, certainly on the indemnity claim, they would have been very different because the measure of damages in an indemnity claim is in part the amounts that the indemnity, here D.R. Horton, was required to pay to resolve the first party action. In addition, the indemnity is entitled to recover costs of defense. In this case, D.R. Horton's cost of resolving the first party claims, at least that part of the first party claims that related to these subcontractors, was, as I said, about $3.78 million. So the damages that were awarded of $18,000 for breach of warranty didn't come close to approximating those amounts. And it's not surprising because the jury heard no evidence of what D.R. Horton had to spend to resolve the claim.
I understand what you're saying and the harm you allege. But let's assume for the moment that the court did not err in keeping out the evidence, or at least didn't abuse its discretion. Let's assume that the court did err in its breach of contract instruction. You only got $20,000 or so for the breach of warranty, correct?
Yes, we got $18,000.
And the court refused to set aside those damages. So that's enough. Maybe I would have given more, but the jury didn't. What would have been different? If you went back on retrial, how would a trial judge sort out the difference in damages between breach of warranty and breach of contract?
Well, the problem is that it's not really possible in this case to separate things out as neatly as you would like, Judge Rothenberg, because we have problems with the $18,000, and they're very real problems. I realize that the standard of review on a damages verdict like this is abuse of discretion, but we have a well-established body of Colorado law that says when the evidence that both parties put on is of damages of X amount and the jury awards damages of a fraction of that, then by definition, the jury has disregarded the evidence and the jury's damage award can't stand, and that's what occurred here. Even though our damages were substantially higher than what the subcontractors were arguing for, their own experts conceded a certain number of defects in each of their subcontractors' work.
Can I ask you about that? Because I think you're saying they conceded both the defects and an amount.
That's correct.
They conceded both, not just, well, we had some defects that totaled 124, but we were only responsible for part of those defects.
No, no. I spent last night reviewing the experts' testimony for the subcontractors, both the liability experts and the damages experts. There are three subcontractors. One of them, Kiowa, didn't have a damages expert, but they all had experts to talk about what part of our work is defective. And each of those experts testified unequivocally, well, yes, I agree. This is a problem. That is a problem. That is a problem. Now, they also said they disagreed with many of the defects that D.R. Horton's experts testified to. Then they had, two of them had damages experts who quantified only the damages associated with the defects that their own liability experts conceded existed. So we really do have a situation where you had undisputed testimony of at least some minimal amount of damages, and yet the jury's verdicts came in at about, I believe, 5% of those amounts. I could be off on my math. And so this can't be a case where you can justify that by saying, well, the jury was entitled not to believe the experts. Because in this case, if the only way they could have gotten at a verdict that low was to believe neither of the experts' testimony, and these were subjects that required expert testimony to quantify, to identify the defects and to quantify them. And if they believe neither of the experts, then we've really got a problematic verdict. In any event, the appropriate result on that issue is to reverse and to remand for a new trial, not to try to figure out, well, what should the damages have been, because obviously that's the jury's job. But what this verdict tells us is that the jury didn't do its job. Somehow it messed it up, and what we need is a new trial on damages on the warranty claim. We also believe we deserve a new trial on damages on the indemnity claim and a new trial in full on the breach of contract claim.
Is that what you asked for in your briefs?
Yes.
For some reason, I was under the impression that you said if only the breach of warranty is the problem, remanded for entry of 124, 86, and 124.
No, that is not what we requested. What we requested is what I just said, and for the reasons I just said. If I can return to the exclusion of evidence, I'm starting with that kind of oddly, perhaps, given the standard of review of an evidentiary ruling, because of how very important it is to this case. I mean, fundamentally, what we have here is a first-party action saying this project was a mess. It had all of these problems. You have a developer, D.R. Horton, that didn't ever lift a hammer, didn't do any of the work. It was a developer. It hired subcontractors to do that work. So if it's going to write a check for $25 million, it's obviously and naturally and rightfully under its contract going to look to its subcontractors to cover their share of those settlement costs, their reasonable share of whatever was a reasonable settlement, which is all we are arguing for on appeal. And so the only way for a jury to decide what is a reasonable share, if any, for these subcontractors to bear of those of that settlement amount, the only way is to let the jury know what was settled, what were the terms, why did you settle, was it reasonable to settle, how did you come up with an amount, how did you allocate to these subcontractors. The jury heard none of that, and I think it's interestingly well illustrated by an objection that the district court sustained to this question. Do you know the damages that D.R. Horton is claiming against the third-party defendants in this case? That's at volume 13 of the transcript on pages 183 to 184. The question was, what are D.R. Horton's damages? And that drew vigorous objections, as did similar questions in the same part of the transcript, from the subcontractors, who said, that witness can't answer that question because that would violate the court's order, which had been entered previously, about the settlement evidence. The only way to answer the question on what are the damages would be to tell the jury, we just wrote a check for this amount, and this part of it is attributable to these subcontractors. At least that's what we say. But the jury never got to hear any of that. So the evidence is directly relevant to the indemnity claim, and I don't believe the subcontractors have ever questioned the relevance. Instead, they've asserted a bunch of procedural roadblocks. They've claimed that the record was inadequate, that there was invited error, that there was waiver, and that the error is harmless. The record was perfectly adequate. D.R. Horton designated the complete record, and all of the tendered and given instructions are in the record. D.R. Horton objected to the instructions that it's objecting to on the indemnity claim, which is related to the settlement evidence.
Let's go back to the claim that you were talking about, though, the exclusion of the evidence. And you're saying that for a trial court to exclude new evidence that is obtained on the eve of trial is necessarily an abuse of discretion. Will always be an abuse of discretion.
No, Your Honor, we are not saying that it will always be. We are saying in this case, which is of course all that this court can look at, it was new evidence, and that's the important point. This evidence didn't exist. There was nothing held back. There were no surprises. The subcontractors knew that D.R. Horton was trying to settle these claims with the first party plaintiffs, and they were invited to participate in the mediations as recently as in January, a month earlier. Some subcontractors continued to participate, those who were interested in settling, through February, and they settled their claims as well. So as soon as the claim settled, which was through no fault of D.R. Horton's, not until the eve of trial, D.R. Horton brought that information to the court's attention and to the subcontractor's attention. They cried prejudice because this was new information. And D.R. Horton said, we don't want you to be prejudiced. We want you to have the opportunity to engage in some discovery about the settlement. We can do that and still adhere to the trial court's trial schedule because we've just eliminated a lot of evidence from this case because we don't have first-party claims anymore. The subcontractors didn't want to engage in discovery. They didn't want to obviate any potential prejudice from this development. They preferred to do exactly what the trial court allowed them to do so that they could come to this court and cry prejudice. But there wouldn't have been any prejudice if they had simply taken advantage and if the court had allowed them to take advantage of the opportunity for discovery into the terms of the settlement.
So you're saying that this evidence was so important that it was an abuse of discretion not to continue the case?
Absolutely. And the only reasons that the trial court gave for excluding this evidence was not the relevance or irrelevance of the evidence. That never came up. It was not any other basis for not admitting the evidence, such as hearsay or Daubert-type analysis, although we don't think that would have applied here because this wasn't scientific evidence. But it was solely based on the fact that D.R. Horton first disclosed the evidence on the eve of trial and that the court wanted to adhere to its schedule. Legitimate concerns, but far outweighed in this case, we believe, by the critical nature of the evidence and the importance of the evidence, not just to the indemnity claim, most directly relevant to the indemnity claim because it constituted the measure of damages for that claim, but independently relevant to all the claims because, as we explained in our briefs, this evidence directly corroborated the testimony of D.R. Horton's experts concerning the damages attributable to these subcontractors for their defective work. We had experts who were throwing out large numbers, and they were understandably, the jury could have been understandably suspicious of those large numbers. It would have been far less suspicious if it had understood that D.R. Horton had written a large check corresponding to these subcontractors' defects. And so that evidence would have independently supported all of D.R. Horton's claims.
Counsel, are there decisions that you're aware of where Rule 26 disclosures of this magnitude have been allowed on the day of trial or the day
I'm certainly aware of decisions where supplemental disclosures under Rule 26E have been allowed close to trial. I can't tell you off the top of my head one of the day of trial. I believe that there are some, though, and I would be happy to supplement our briefing with a letter to the court identifying those.
Well, we'll look in your briefs.
Okay. I have...
We'll look in the briefs.
I'd like to reserve my last 45 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, good morning. My name is Dean Neuwirth, registration 17181. With me is co-counsel Gene Dabowski. The jury did hear this $3.78 million number. The number in the settlement allocation that Judge King excluded was exactly the same number that Horton's experts, who used to be the homeowner's experts, testified to at trial. If you go back and you look at where that 3.78 number comes from, it's the number that John Hope testified to during his direct examination at trial, which I cited in our answer brief, volume 17, 148 to 160. If you add up the numbers there, what you get is $4.4 million. That was before Mr. Wilson, trial lawyer, cross-examined Mr. Hope and got a concession from him that almost $600,000 of that $4.4 million was overblown. The judge struck that. Horton has not appealed that. That gets you down to $3.8 million. That's the same number that Ms. Glenn is talking about. And in fact, at the very beginning of closing argument, and again, this is cited in our answer brief, Horton's counsel started out by asking the jury for $3.8 million. So admitting the settlement allocation would have been cumulative of the evidence that the jury heard. Now, the reason in our answer brief that we say it would not have helped the credibility of Horton's experts to admit that evidence is because the evidence was self-serving as formulated by Horton before trial. As the trial continued and the adversary process tested it, the number kept ratcheting down. If you actually go back and you look at the settlement allocations in the exhibits B15, N15, and K15, they include prejudgment interest.
Counsel, is it your position that the evidence would not have been admissible even if timely disclosed?
Absolutely, and here's why. I'm getting to that. They start out with $5.8 million and includes prejudge interest. They told the judge before trial the prejudgment interest was 30%. You knock that out, you get the $4.4 million. That's what John Hope, their expert, testified to at trial. You reduce that by the $600,000 that Mr. Wilson showed was improper, you're down to $3.8 million. What happened thereafter as they went through the adversarial process was that Horton voluntarily jettisoned a bunch of its alleged defects so that when they get to closing, they say they listed a number that was actually $2.3 million, and this is discussed in the answer brief as well. $1.5 million, depending on how you round your numbers, of their damages just evaporates under their own numbers at the closing argument. So they're left with total damages of $2.3 million. So the reason we said in our answer brief that it wouldn't have helped their credibility for them to introduce another number was that they were undercutting their own numbers. They already had two contradictory sets. Now they want to introduce a third.
Well, to go back to my question, why was the evidence not admissible? I understand that there was controversy about it. It was disputed.
It's completely unreliable. It's inadmissible under Rule 702 as expert testimony because it's unreliable. 30% of it is inadmissible because it's prejudgment interest, which is a question of law for the court to decide, not an issue for the jury. Furthermore, under the Goodyear case that the Supreme Court decided last year, much of that prejudgment interest was likely not awardable anyway because prejudgment interest does not begin to accrue when you have damage to property until the damage is actually repaired. In addition, the number was a lump sum number. It lacked foundation. There was no methodology given as to how the number was determined. It was self-serving, as the adversarial process showed. And there are some other reasons that are listed in the brief, but there are a myriad number of reasons, Your Honor, why the evidence was just unreliable, and therefore the judge did not abuse his discretion in excluding it.
But the evidence, as you indicated, the figure of $4.4 million was admissible, right?
It came in.
All right.
Yes, it was admitted. And once you subtract out the $600,000 in engineering fees that should not have been included, that gets you to the $3.8 million that Ms. Glenn is talking about. The jury heard it. But it kept ratcheting lower as the adversarial process tested it until by the very end of the trial, Horton itself had reduced the number to $2.3 million.
Do you agree, counsel, with opposing counsel's statement that the subcontractor's experts admitted both defects and an amount of damages that would be required to repair those defects?
Do not. I read the record very differently than they do in that regard. I think when you read the entire record, what you see is a very hotly disputed trial about whether there was any damage at all other than maybe five leaky windows. And if there was any other damage, what it cost. And the way I read the testimony of my client's experts is that they were setting a ceiling to damages, not a floor. That their position was anywhere from zero to 80,000, 120,000 at worst, not somewhere from 80,000, 120,000 on up to the $2.3 million that Horton ultimately requested. And I think the proof is in the pudding in that the jury was instructed appropriately under Colorado law that you can believe all the testimony of a witness, some of it or none of it, and that includes expert witnesses. That's what juries do when we ask them to decide damages in a civil case.
Nonetheless, at closing, Bischoff's lawyer said, in analyzing the buildings, that my client was responsible for framing, the total cost of repairs was $86,892.
I don't think you can pluck any one statement by any one lawyer or expert out of the record that way and read it in a vacuum. This is a huge record. This is the biggest trial record that I've personally ever reviewed. And in order to understand the context in which that statement is made, you really have to understand the context of the whole trial. And the context of the whole trial is that Horton's damages are greatly overblown. To the extent there were damages, we are not responsible for them, we being the framers. And to the extent there's anything left over, it's harmless. It's the kind of stuff
that counsel for Bischoff said his client was responsible for $86,000 in damages.
But he also said during his closing that there was basically no damage. I don't know what to tell you, Judge, other than that my position is if you read the closings and the evidence of everybody and you look at how that's how the jury is going to be evaluating this case. First of all, in terms of their argument about judicial admission, it's a new argument raised on appeal. When they were sitting at trial, certainly the trial lawyers for Horton didn't view these isolated statements by the lawyers for my clients as such a binding admission that they stood up and objected or asked immediately outside the presence of the jury for an instruction to the jury that my clients had suddenly stipulated to damages of a certain level.
Are you saying the lawyers for your clients below stated alternative positions? We're not responsible for much. The most we'd be responsible for is?
Exactly. With respect to counsel's statement about the lateness of this evidence, this settlement evidence, there were no slack times for the court to hear this. Counsel in their reply brief rattled off a list of dates where they said the prejudice accruing through the late admission of this evidence could have been resolved. If you look at volume 4, page 15 of the record, you will see that there was a pretrial conference on February 7th in which the court said, we're not having trial on this case on the following dates because I have docket and other matters that need to be dealt with. And the judge rattled off a list of dates, which are most of the dates that Horton has said in its reply brief could have been used. So those dates were actually unavailable. Another date Horton said could have been used, February 19th, was President's Day in the year 2007. Another day Horton said could have been used, March 14th, was the day that the court held an all-day, off-the-record jury instruction conference, which is why we actually do not have a complete record with respect to one of the jury instruction issues that Horton has raised. And so there just wasn't any slack time for the court to take up this late proffered evidence, even if it had been admissible.
Couldn't have continued it a month or two?
He couldn't, Judge, because the jury was picked, when they picked the jurors on February 12th and 13th of 07, excuse me, I have a cold, so my voice is a little weak. They did so on the basis that the trial would be over by March 20th, and the jurors were told that. So they risked a mistrial if they went past that date because there was no assurance that the jurors would have been able to stay.
The jury was selected before this information was disclosed?
The jury was selected essentially contemporaneously with it.
February was the 2 days following the disclosure.
Excuse me?
I understood from the briefs that it was the 2 days following the disclosure. The Monday morning, they came into court and said, we reached a settlement. The court said, okay, you can have until noon or something like that, and then we'll get to the afternoon or whatever, and then we'll start with jury selection.
They did come in Monday morning and said, we've reached a settlement. My recollection is they started picking the jury on February 12th, that Monday. Jury selection continued the next day, which was the third.
So the jury wasn't selected when they disclosed information?
No, I think by the time they filed their actual disclosure, the jury had been picked. I think the disclosure was filed on the 14th, but I'm not sure. I'd have to check the record to be certain about that.
But by that time, the judge had ruled you weren't getting a Horton wasn't getting a continuance.
That's correct. That's correct.
So let me go back again. Is why couldn't any prejudice have been alleviated through a continuance?
There was no
jury hadn't been selected at this point when we're arguing about it.
Well, the jurors were waiting. That's certainly
the jurors were waiting.
The jurors were waiting. Right. There was no. First of all, the normal policies that under the Todd v. Bear Valley case and some of the other cases cited in the brief, they say that you don't continue a trial unless there is a completely unforeseen circumstance. And one of the points that we've made here is that although Horton was entitled to settle with the homeowners on the eve of trial, it was a 50% decisional participant in that settlement. And even if it had no control over the homeowners, it certainly knew that by deciding to settle on the eve of trial, there would be consequences for its disclosures in its upcoming trial against the subcontractors. And the idea is you don't get to have your cake and eat it too.
Your suggestion is they should have held off on the settlement until after the trial was over?
My suggestion is that you can't have your cake and eat it too. That if you make a decision to settle with Party A on the eve of trial and you want to go forward with Party B, you have to understand that when you settle with Party A, that evidence regarding that settlement is probably not going to be admissible in your trial with the other party because it comes too late. You ought to try and settle sooner. And if you can't, that's just the way the cookie crumbles because the court system functions on the basis that these rules are going to be followed. And this was not the kind of emergency situation that required a continuance. And as I said, the information was cumulative in any event.
I'd like to ask you the question I asked your opponent about the difference. You claim or contend that the damages were duplicitous as to warranty, breach of warranty, and breach of contract. Your opponent disagrees. Could you comment on that?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, I'd say that's a new argument that they made for the first time in their reply brief, and I'd ask the court to disregard it on that basis.
Wasn't it in response to the argument you made in your answer brief? Wasn't it directly in response to the argument you made in your answer brief?
Well, the argument I made in my answer brief was that Instruction 2 said the same damages are being sought for three alternate claims. This was an issue. It's not an issue that was never foreseeable to them. I mean, they haven't objected to Instruction 2 on that ground. They've never appealed the validity of Instruction 2.
I thought in your answer brief you said it's harmless because they already got the damages through the breach of warranty. And you listed several different grounds. And so the response was, well, wait a minute, breach of warranty damages and breach of contract damages are different. I'm not sure that's a new argument as much as in response to an argument you made in your answer brief. I don't want to take up any more of your time.
I see it as a new argument, Judge. Obviously, you wear the black robe, and you may disagree. If you look at the record, Judge Rothenberg, the evidence and the argument and the instructions make absolutely no differentiation among the three claims. In fact, early on, just before trial, Horton was given the option of jettisoning, the breach of warranty and breach of contract claim and just pursuing the breach of indemnity claim. And it said on the record it was considering doing that and then decided that it had changed its mind. What it ended up presenting to the jury in terms of actual evidence adduced and actual argument presented was, here's a bunch of defects. We think that they cost X. We want you, members of the jury, to reimburse us for having paid the homeowners for those defects. And there was no distinction as to which defects or what amounts might fall under one of the three claims or not. It was the single body of evidence giving rise to three alternate theories of breach of contract. And the jury was properly instructed in that regard, and it properly awarded damages under one of the claims for the de minimis amount of damages it found actually had occurred. Unless the court has any other questions, I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you.
We ask the court to affirm the judgment of the trial court.
If you thought I was talking fast before, get ready. First of all, Mr. Neuwirth's argument that the jury heard the number proves our point. What they heard was our expert talking about the value of the defects and the damages associated with the defects. What the jury didn't hear was that that's what we valued those defects as at when we settled the first party claim, and that's what the Homeowners Association valued them at. Mr. Neuwirth is arguing about the strength of the evidence, not about its admissibility. I don't believe he ever challenged the relevance of this evidence, and it certainly wasn't excluded on the basis of relevance or any other type of inadmissibility.
Thank you, counsel. Any questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you both for your arguments. This case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. This concludes.